At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. This is an oldie but a goodie, I know. I do, though, have to bring it out from time to time. Stocks go down too, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 18th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I want to take a quick second here and do a little reality check. Won't be long, won't be complicated, I promise, but it's important. The stock market lately going down and bond yields going up, that is what's supposed to be happening right now. Let me back up here for a minute. Interest rates have been near zero for years now, right? That has meant, broadly speaking, that the stock market has been the only place to put your money if you want to make money. So far, so good? Okay, good. Now, along come Jay Powell and the Fed, and they say, hey, you know what? The economy's doing all right. We need to start thinking about raising interest rates. Not actually raising them yet, mind you, just thinking about it. And what happens? The yield, the interest rate on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note, which like 6 weeks ago was at 1.3%, today closed above 1.8%. Yes, that is still crazy low, but it's a big jump in a month and a half. And now people have places to put their money that is not stocks. And here we are. Stocks go down too. I hope that made sense, because all of this, it is what is supposed to be happening. All right, enough of that. The corporate news of this, what are we, Tuesday, is video games. Microsoft is going to spend almost $69 billion to buy Activision Blizzard, the maker of, among others, Call of Duty, Candy Crush, and World of Warcraft. Which one of those is not like the other? It is, this deal, Microsoft's biggest acquisition ever, but it is not necessarily a big surprise, as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher explains.
When you think of Microsoft, your mind probably doesn't go to shoot-'em-up video games like Call of Duty.
Mission accomplished. Good work, Marines.
Microsoft has sort of a button-down shirt reputation.
Microsoft became a juggernaut on the, you know, with computer software you use in your office.
Margaret O'Meara studies the tech industry at the University of Washington. Now, Microsoft has Xbox and a couple of video game studios, but O'Meara says its purchase of Activision Blizzard takes it to another level.
This is not just video games played by kids or teenagers in their rec rooms. This is a massive global industry with billions of users.
Activision Blizzard has recently been accused of gender pay disparity and widespread sexual harassment in the workplace. A hailstorm of bad PR, as O'Meara calls it.
Revelations about its workplace culture have spilled out into the public eye, where there is new employee activism and pushback against the way that it is run.
Activision Blizzard's culture is a key challenge for Microsoft. Kate Edwards with Geography is a video game industry consultant. She says Microsoft has an opportunity to improve Activision Blizzard's problematic culture.
And then you have maybe like the older sibling come along and say, hey, I'm going to help you out. You know, I think I can fix some of the issues that you're dealing with.
Of course, Microsoft is in this for profit. It wants to stake out territory in the lucrative so-called gaming metaverse, says Tom Bittman, leading Microsoft analyst for Gartner.
There's a land grab going on right now to take a position in gaming and in cloud computing and social software.
And Bittman says the tech players that grab that space now are going to be the strong ones in the future. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, I think we went over that, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I don't know if you remember this, but one of the really early tells that this pandemic was going to turn into an economic problem was when Apple said back in January of 2020, 2 years ago, that it was having a tough time getting shipments from China because of the factory shutdowns over there in response to the virus. A supply side shock is what that's called. We are, of course, having a demand shock in this economy right now, as we all want. We all demand the goods we went without during the worst of the virus, right? But right now, there are tens of millions of people in China completely locked down or otherwise restricted as Omicron spreads over there. That includes key manufacturing centers and key port cities as well. And that, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishor explains, means nothing good at all for the global supply chain.
Omicron is in China.
What's happening in China right now is the most serious COVID-19 surge since the original outbreak in Wuhan.
Sam Scarpino is managing director of pathogen surveillance at the Rockefeller Foundation's Pandemic Prevention Institute. China has a zero COVID policy that has worked well so far, says Nargiza Salijanova with the Rhodium Group.
When there is an infection detected, there is a mass lockdown, which disrupts huge cities, massive population. It affects factory production.
That's happening now in several cities and areas. Brendan McKenna is an international economist at Wells Fargo Securities.
And it just so happens to be that the cities and provinces are a major supplier of computer chips, technology products. There's a lot of ports that are being disrupted.
China's options are complicated for a few reasons. The Lunar New Year and the Olympics are both coming up, making controlling Omicron a priority. And its population may be more vulnerable. Some evidence suggests the Sinovac vaccine is less effective than others at producing antibodies that neutralize Omicron, says Rockefeller Scarpino. Taken together, he says it makes for a very complex situation.
What makes it harder to predict is what kinds of measures are coming tomorrow to try and control the spread, and how many people are going to be affected by those.
The sense now is that there will be disruptions felt here. Delayed products, thwarted deliveries, continued inflation, but they may take a while to arrive. Again, Wells Fargo's Brendan McKenna.
I think it's probably going to take at least a month, possibly two, for the disruptions and kind of the way China is handling the COVID outbreaks to actually show up in economic data and for financial markets to actually respond to that.
On the other hand, companies do have some experience at this point dealing with disruptions. Chad Flieger heads the supply chain practice at accounting and advisory firm BDO.
This time around, I think being proactive and getting out in front of the problem will shorten the back end of how long it could last.
Either way, though, this ultimately means the supply chain problems we thought were coming to a close may well go on for longer. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
These have not been the best of times for the health policy communications industry, the professionals whose job it is, especially in confusing and scary times, to make sure the public gets the information it needs to know clearly and in as timely a manner as possible. That, as we all know, has not been the case the past couple of years, so we got Cynthia Bauer on the phone. She is a health literacy and communications expert who worked at the CDC for more than a decade. She's now at the University of Maryland. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Is health literacy usually this hard? It just seems to me we've been going around and around.
Actually, it is pretty hard because human communication is pretty hard.
There's a lot of misunderstanding and confusion that goes on, and COVID has just kind of been exhibit A of how hard it is.
Well, I was just going to say, you throw in a pandemic and everybody's sort of awareness and agita goes up a factor of 10. Is there an easy way out of the communications mess that we find ourselves in now with public health, do you think?
There's not an easy way, but there is a way out. And part of that is to kind of get back to the communication basics, which are to explain things very clearly and simply in a jargon-free way, and to do it as frequently as possible.
I wonder, though, if that's part of the problem, right? Because this is health literacy and health communication is not standard brand communication, right? Advertising is you gotta hit people with it a zillion times. And now it seems to me that there's almost too much information, some of it conflicting, that is making the health communications consuming public a little bit weary.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because there is a lot of information out there, but there's a lot of information that is either intentionally or maybe unintentionally kind of confusing the information environment. So, for example, there are a lot of people who've decided they want to try and interpret what the federal agencies like CDC and FDA are saying. And in many ways, that is muddying the waters as much as being helpful.
Yeah. You were at the CDC for many years, and I just wonder, based on your experience and your insights, do you imagine that the communications professionals there, because government agencies have communications professionals just like brands and companies do, do you imagine they're pulling their hair out?
I imagine they're pretty tired, yeah. And I imagine they're pretty frustrated that things haven't gone better. I know they're very dedicated and they're really trying to do their best, but this is a pretty complicated situation. And, you know, unfortunately, some of the early communication about the virus really sort of set things off in a pretty difficult path. So they've got a lot of ground to cover and make up for.
Give me your perspective, would you, as a communications professional and as a woman who's done health literacy communications for her life. When you look at what the CDC and others have been doing, what happens on the inside? How does that message get out and then get garbled?
Well, it's a pretty complicated process. There are people with the designated role of being a health communicator or a health educator, and they work in teams, right? So they work with the other subject matter experts about whatever the issue is, in this case, COVID. In the best case, they work on drafting that information together, but it still has to go up a chain through a clearance process. And, you know, CDC might not be the only agency that's involved in creating it. Other federal agencies might weigh in, external partners, for example, state health departments. So it's a pretty complicated multi-step process. And in a way, we really do want our federal agencies kind of thinking about all these different factors before they put out information that could change not just public policies, but also people's individual behaviors.
On the theory that you're going to get invited to participate in whatever the postmortem is for health communication during this pandemic, give me a letter grade. How are we doing so far?
I would say a C. You know, I think we haven't completely failed it. I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that people have learned some things about infectious disease and what public health does and sort of how to protect themselves. But unfortunately, we're really far from where we could have been if the communication had worked, you know, like it should have from the beginning. So I would say it's not a total failure yet, but I think we could have done so much better along the way.
Cynthia Bowers, the director of the Horowitz Center for Health Literacy at the University of Maryland, the School of Public Health there. Ms. Bowers, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. It's been great.
Coming up.
That's where you're going to find the notices posted for rummage sales.
Where do you go, do you suppose, when you don't have the internet? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 543, 1.5%, closed at 35,368. Can't be surprised at the Wawa's today. NASDAQ off 386, 2.6%, 14,506. S&P 500 dropped 85 points, about 1.8%. 45 and 77. Another earnings season is upon us. Touched on this on Friday. Among companies reporting results today, Goldman Sachs missed estimates on earnings per share and expenses were up. Goldman shares down nearly 7% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Talked about this a little bit. This is important. 1.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You pay the federal government $80 billion. You kind of hope you're going to be able to use whatever it is you bought. But not so fast, because the 5G tug-of-war continues. AT&T and Verizon, as you might have heard, were set to roll out the latest stage of their 5G services tomorrow after having bought the spectrum from the government at auction last year. C-band, the letter C, band, is the specific part of the airwaves we're talking about here. And that can interfere with aviation equipment, specifically, as you know, radar altimeters, which measure a plane's height above the terrain. Very important. Airlines and the FAA say that potential interference is a very bad thing, and today, AT&T and Verizon agreed to limit their 5G networks around some airports. Thing is, this is not a new fight. So instead of rehashing the past, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer will now divine the future.
It's July 18th, 2022, the height of the summer travel season, and airlines and wireless carriers still aren't playing nicely over 5G.
It's not going to be fully rolled out, and it's not going to be rolled out universally.
Todd Curtis is a former safety engineer at Boeing who started the website airsafe.com. He says airlines might have to change planes' electronics and software to make them compatible with 5G.
But that's not something that can be done instantly. It's not like a software upload on a Tesla or something.
And airlines are very conservative and cautious about safety. Ella Atkins, an aerospace engineering professor at the University of Michigan, says that could lead to a clash in court, causing more delays in the rollout. Atkins says the airlines might sue if they think they can prove flight disruptions were caused by the 5G rollout.
So every time you cause a plane to not fly because of something like an interference problem, or you cause it to divert, say, to an alternate airport, that's really expensive.
Nobody wants to be sued, which is why we could still see buffer zones around airports in 6 months where there's no 5G service. So if you're flying this summer, your phone might be a little sluggish, says Joe Kane with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation.
You could end up with a situation where you have 4G while you're sitting in the airport or on the runway that's going to be slower than the 5G you experienced at home and maybe even as you're driving to the airport.
Kane says we might see a progressive rollback of the airport buffer zones with 5G towers around airports gradually turned on after more testing to resolve any interference with planes. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The World Economic Forum in Davos has fallen victim to the pandemic for the second year in a row. The now not so annual meeting of the rich, famous, and politically and economically connected was supposed to be happening this week. It's obviously not, but the World Economic Forum itself, that is to say the very establishment organization behind the event, wants you to know it's worried about the environment. A new report from the group says the loss of biodiversity is putting the economies of cities around the world at risk. $31 trillion, the report says, in economic activity in those cities is at risk of disruption from flooding and drought, intense heat, and pollution. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on the mitigation desk today.
Over hundreds of years, humans have paved over streams and wetlands and clear-cut forests to build cities. Todd Gartner directs the Cities for Forests initiative at the World Resources Institute, and he says now cities are feeling the impact.
More floods, worse air quality, food insecurity, and higher unemployment.
In 2019, the World Economic Forum found flooding alone cost more than $46 billion. And as the climate continues to change, Gartner says,
these issues are only going to get more intense in the years to come. We've got to change that trajectory if we want a thriving economy.
Many cities around the world are trying to change that trajectory by investing more in green infrastructure or in nature-based solutions.
We used to just call it nature before it was largely decimated.
Kate Orff is a professor at Columbia University and the founder of the landscape architecture firm Scape.
So trees to clean our air, low points, woodland forests and floodplain forests to help absorb floodwaters, etc.
There are environmental and economic benefits to restoring wetlands and forests within cities and building more bike lanes and rain gardens, says Antonia Gavel, head of climate at the World Economic Forum.
It doesn't have to be a kind of trade-off between growing city infrastructure and actually preserving nature and natural ecosystems. It's not more expensive. It is actually better from an economic standpoint.
And in some cases, it's even cheaper. On average, Gavel says, nature-based solutions cost cities about 50% less to build than man-made alternatives. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The United States Postal Service lost $4.9 billion last year, $9.2 billion in red ink in 2020. We could keep going farther back, but why? You get the idea. The post office loses money at a blistering rate. I should say here, full disclosure, they do spend part of it on us. They're an underwriter of this program. The Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, continues to push his controversial 10-year turnaround plan, consolidating and closing branches, cutting hours, raising prices, and slowing down delivery that would affect what the agency calls the fringes of its network. Others call it rural America, where the Postal Service is often the only delivery game in town. So Marketplace's Savannah Marr took a trip out to those fringes.
30 miles of red dirt roads connect U.S. Highway 550 to Torreon, New Mexico, home to about 300 people on the eastern edge of the Navajo Nation and to a jewelry studio owned by J.J. Otero.
So all these stamps have little designs in the tips of them. So that's the one I'm looking for.
A tiny room on the far end of Otero's trailer has just enough space for all his tools and materials for making high-end jewelry. He's using steel stamps to impress a paisley pattern into a sheet of silver.
In this case, I'll use a smaller hammer and use more of a tapping technique.
5 years ago, Otero left his IT job in Albuquerque and moved home to care for his aging parents. At first, he wasn't sure he could support himself as a full-time artist, but by promoting his work on Facebook and Instagram, he's found clients all over the country.
I just sent off mailings today. Some went to Portland, Oregon. Others went to Louisiana, Kentucky, Phoenix.
But that's not easy.
For me, I have to get in my truck, drive half hour one way, 1 hour round trip to drop those pieces off at the post office.
And to ship via UPS or FedEx, he'd have to drive all the way to Albuquerque.
That's a two and a half hour round trip.
The Postal Service's founding mission was to serve rural Americans. That commitment got harder to fulfill as the country got larger, and today the post office has lost a lot of business with the advent of email and e-commerce. Jonathan Haladic with the Center for Rural Affairs lives in Craig, Nebraska, population 199, where he says people rely on the post office to receive their medication, to pay their bills, to keep their small businesses afloat.
Rural communities depend so much on entrepreneurship. When there aren't jobs around you, you create those jobs, and you need the Postal Service to be there, to be consistent, to be reliable.
But Postmaster General Louis DeJoy says the Postal Service, which is a current underwriter of this program, needs to stop losing money. Hence his 10-year cost savings plan. Hladek says the agency's business model is worth a look.
It's really important to steward taxpayer dollars. And I'm not saying that taxpayers should be bailing out rural postal service. But we know we're using it. We know it improves our quality of life. We know we need it for the basic necessities.
On the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota, Twyla Baker, who heads up the tribal college, says the post office is a place where the community comes together and shares information in the absence of widespread internet access.
That's where you're going to find the notices posted for rummage sales. Things of that nature. You know, somebody selling a car, that's where they're posted.
Not to mention, mail-in voting is popular for folks who might otherwise drive an hour to their nearest polling place.
If we were to diminish their ability to vote by mail, then we are essentially cutting a huge portion of the population out.
And in his jewelry studio in Torreon, J.J. Otero says any cuts to the already limited postal service on the Navajo Nation would be a major blow.
I mean, it's tough enough. They're overlooking the fact that poor people need to get mail, and to get mail out. Among those poor people are the indigenous folks that live in areas like here.
Otero says everything connecting him to his clients is tenuous, from his spotty internet connection to the winding dirt roads that become impassable after a snowstorm to the off-reservation post office that could soon become even less accessible. In Torreon, New Mexico, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, part public service announcement, part internet analytics. First, the PSA. If you go to covidtests.gov, covidtests.gov. You can order your four free COVID tests for at-home delivery. Wasn't supposed to be live till tomorrow, but it works now, so sign yourself up. Item number two and related, just before I came into the studio just now, there were almost 1.6 million people on government websites. Analytics.usa.gov if you're curious. But anyway, of that nearly 1.6 million people, a million of them were on those free test sites, which is pretty cool. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context for this Tuesday, brought to you by the letters W, T, and I, West Texas Intermediate. U.S. benchmark crude oil up 2% today on news out of the Middle East, $85.43 a barrel. Coming soon to gas pumps near you. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.